Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. Today is Monday, October 2nd, 2017. Commentary Magazine, the almost 73-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, political analysis, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We ask you to join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe. $19.95 gets you a digital subscription. $29.95 gets you an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
We gather on a terrible day in the United States following the worst mass shooting in this country's history. In Las Vegas, I don't need to rehearse the details for you. More than 50 dead, 400 at area hospitals around Las Vegas, shooting from a 32nd-story window onto a country music outdoor festival from the Mandalay Bay Hotel. The apparent shooter is dead by his own hand, a 66-year-old. Resident of Mesquite, Nevada, who does not who does not appear to have much of a criminal record. There are two things that are raised by such events. One is what, if anything, they say about our culture, and the other is what political measures can, should, will, or should not be taken in the wake of such a disastrous, horrible, evil event. So, Abe, let me start by asking you, these mass shootings, of which there are now, I think, something like 250 over the past 2 years, can we extrapolate from that fact to say that there is something particularly diseased or problematic or nightmarish about American culture that is responsible for these events?
I don't think so, because, for starters, do we know what the data point to in terms of trends? I mean, we're certainly more aware of the more spectacular shootings. And we have a lot more footage of them, and we sort of live through them collectively more. But is this something that's happening more than it used to? I mean, it depends
on what you mean by used to.
Right.
Yeah, well, what's your date?
In 2014, the FBI confirmed a sharp rise in mass shootings since 2000. By 2014, mass shootings had tripled since 2011. So there has been an increase in the events of mass shootings. In fact, it was weird, as though it was at the time, it was the phenomenon was gun violence was going down even as mass shootings were increasing.
Right. I see.
So the issue, so that then raises two subsidiary issues. One of which is, what does it say about our culture that we are seeing this increase in these kind of what, you know, you might call sort of spectacular events of mass murder? Does that say something about us in general, or does it say something about the specifics of mass murderous mass shooting events, that they seem to generate copycat killings, or they have put in the minds of people who might otherwise not be triggered into these sorts of fantasies that can be made flesh, made horrible, nightmarish flesh, by the fact that they take place in other places, which is why a lot of us have always wondered whether, you know, the coverage and the all of that is wildly counterproductive, in the sense that it there are people in the world who would say, man, I want to be just like that Adam Lanza. I mean, look, he's dead, but now he's world famous and everyone will know who he is for the rest of his life, that kind of thing.
Right. So I think you can then say that it speaks to something sick, perhaps, in that we make a new class of celebrity for sort of any trend, repulsive trends as well. But I don't think it speaks to something sick in us along the lines of, are we becoming do we care less about human suffering? Are we more interested in making other people suffer? Things along that along those lines, I think, are absolutely not the case. I don't think there's a sort of sickness of a sort of violent sickness of the American soul at work here.
Well, there are people who would say that we are the, you know, without unquestionably the most violent democracy in the world. In other words, in terms of the number of people who are killed simply in the course of, you know, going through their lives. We are the most violent of the democracies, yeah. And that, you know, then there are all sorts of questions about it. Is that because of heterogeneity? Is it because we have a Second Amendment that guarantees people the right to keep and bear arms, and that this has proven to, you know, be a double-edged sword, a mixed blessing, however you want to call it?
Yeah, and in fact, that was Seymour Martin Lipset, I believe, who wrote about American exceptionalism quite a bit. His book of collected works on that was called American Exceptionalism, A Double-Edged Sword. Mm-hmm. And what constituted the other edge was that while we are the most charitable, while we have the most freedoms of any other country, any other democracy, we are more violent. And we right. have been.
We have been. For... I mean, two of the, you know, most interesting books about the origins of the American culture, David Hackett Fisher's Albion Rising, which basically is a story of tells the story of the founding of America as a story of the sort of four nations that formed America, which are basically England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. And how those cultures, though we don't think of the British Isles as being a particularly violent place at all. In fact, those cultures were full of tribal warfare, internal strife, and they came to the United States, and then they all went to war with themselves and each other. Domestic war, you know, the famous Hatfields and McCoys and stuff like that. And then Born Fighting by James Webb, the former Navy Secretary, novelist, senator from Virginia, and presidential candidate, which basically speculates that the whole thing about the culture of the Scots-Irish culture is that it is a culture of honor violence, about, you know, defending your own, defending your prerogatives, and using violence as a way of establishing your manhood and your, you know, and your territory and all of that, and that this is writ into the DNA of the United States and for good and ill.
And Noah? This is all fascinating, and I think it frankly advances the conversation a lot better than anybody else has done over the course of the last 24 hours, but forgive me if I can say that it's perhaps a tiny bit fatuous, because we have no idea about anything about this guy, what he thought, what his background was, what his inclinations were, what his mental state was, what the weapons he used were. We don't know one single fact. And so we sort of engage in this navel gazing and, you know, self-interested, you know, slopsism. And
I don't think it adds much to the
conversation, insofar as what people are looking for here is an explanation, and they'll never find it in that sort.
Well, that's of course the horror, the particular monstrous genius of a lot of these mass killers is the fact that they make sure that they're dead at the end of the process, right? So because they're dead, we can never find out what motivated them really, and as a result, they become Rorschach tests for the rest of us. So, you know, Adam Lanza, the Sandy Hook killer, there he is. He's dead. We don't know why he went and shot up 20 first graders. All we can do is piece together pieces and bits of his life and try to see what it is so that maybe there can be weird signposts for other people who at the age of 6 or 7 or 8 see their kids doing stuff and saying, oh my God, I better intervene because this is what Adam Lanza did. And in fact, there was a whole spate. There was various people wrote pieces saying, you know, I have a violent 11-year-old in my house who frightens all of us and mm-hmm. is tormenting all of us. And I look at him and I'm not sure that if we don't do something, he's not going to turn into a mass murderer. I don't think that's not solipsism. I think that's actually a real thing, that one of the virtues of studying the examples of extreme evil, if we know enough about them, is that they can give us some signposts to recognizing it in others and seeing if there's a way to arrest it.
Well, you're talking about individuals, which is absolutely valuable. Before right. we were talking about a national culture, which was right. somehow poisoning our own
but I mean that is the question.
Process. And then the flip side yeah. of that is that we have James Holmes and we have people like Jared Lee Loeffner, who upon reflection are just completely insane.
Right.
And are just clinically insane and do not right. have any sort of something you can draw a much broader lesson from about society.
Well, no, I think there are I disagree with you. I disagree with you about that. I think that what one of the things that we see here is that we live in a society in which admirably we attempt to treat the mentally ill. We try to mainstream them. We try to make sure that they're not. You know, they are not treated as though they are ostracized, or you know that we understand that they are you know victims of diseased thought processes. And on the other hand, it is much more the case now that people that they are let loose, that they can be let loose because we live in a society of license that's sort of beyond liberty. I mean, when people like Holmes's parents say, well, there was nothing we could do about it. You know, we couldn't control him or something like that. It's like, well, that's kind of cold comfort. You know, what do you mean you couldn't control him? Like, if you're not your child's keeper, you're not, you know, if saying I'm not my brother's keeper, when in fact you know that somebody is capable of terrible, monstrous and destructive violence, and our country gives people very little recourse in this regard, in part because we err, understandably, again, on the side of liberty. So it's not like, okay, you're 19 years old and your father can say he's crazy, you better lock him up.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, this is going to be interesting, that this particular thread going forward, because this shooter was 66 years old.
66.
So we'll begin to have an understanding of whether or not there is a record of violence, of mental illness to have acted on, whether people were actually doing something about him along the way or not, or if he had right. fallen through a succession
of cracks.
It's
way too early. Right, that's course, the joke right. no, about, of all yeah. this is that we're hearing he doesn't have much of a record. He's not this. He's not that. Then we learn his father was, you know, one of the 10 most wanted people in the United States in the 1970s. We don't know what we don't know. Like, in fact, it could turn out that, you know, he was wanted for crimes in every state in the country for all we know. You know, it's like just because he wasn't wanted in Nevada doesn't mean that he wasn't in other state databases. We don't know anything about it. And that's one of the things that people always say at the beginning of this process, and nobody follows up on it, which is you can't speculate. You know, everything we're going to find out in the first 24 hours, half of it's going to be false. Half of it's not going to be true. Half of it's going to be nonsense. And we don't know which half, by definition. So we've got to be careful about that.
Well, that is what's so frustrating about all of this, is that nobody observes any sort of, perspective on how they reacted the last time this happened. They only remember the fact that the last time this happened was 16 months ago, and it was insane, and there shouldn't be the amount of mass violence that we have in this country. And also, let's engage in and rehash the debate we had 16 months ago.
Right. But okay, so there are two different debates. That's what I was saying. So the debate that I started entering into with Abe is whether there is a general national condition in the United States that is
fostering. So not to interrupt you, I think that's far more valuable because it's not, I've never heard it. Right. You know, these sort of things are, you're so conditioned and steeped in these debates if you do what we do for a living.
Right.
You sit in front of the television and watch these things happen in real time and you get kind of inured to them. But I've never heard anybody engage in a kind of literary analysis
right.
of the nature of American
sociopathy. I mean, there are two things about the last 100 years, you know, which not just in America, but in the world at large. On the one hand, we've lived through the most violent century. We lived through the 20th century was the most violent century in human history. Two world wars cost, 100 million lives. The regimes in the Soviet Union and China cost another 100 million lives. Unbelievable amounts of state violence and war. And on the other hand, as Steven Pinker points out in his research, violence as a cause of sort of daily dismay, disaster, and horror is in a gigantic centuries-long secular decline. In other words, your possibility of simply being, you know, just like walking down the street and somebody just cutting you in half with a sword, you know, if you want to use some weird example.
Well, no, but here's an example that you could use, and this is also happens as a result of mental illness, and it's also it's another problem. It's like when and this seems to have be happening more often than it used to, when someone gets pushed on the subway tracks in New York, right?
Right. Is that happening more? I feel like it used to happen more.
I don't know if it is. I'm going with my gut. It feels like it. I don't know.
Clocked over the head with a cobblestone.
No, but this is where the copycatting starts coming in. And there is no question that people who are inclined toward, you know, paranoid, violent schizophrenia are deeply affected by things that they hear in the media. And they may never have thought of to push somebody on a subway track. But then the voices in their head, once they see something on TV or something, start that. Then it becomes thinkable. Then they see someone, and they find themselves, you know, possessed by an irresistible impulse to do it to somebody else.
Right.
If they never heard that someone was pushed on a track, they wouldn't have done it. I mean, that's, you know, they are not. That's why we say that, you know, if you're found guilty by not reason of insanity, it's that you were not responsible for your actions because you were in the grip of an irresistible impulse that came from a diseased part of your brain. So and that, you know, there's where we get into the questions of whether or not deinstitutionalization and the fact that we have decided to privatize mental illness in the United States again. Not that I'm saying that's bad, because we are a country dedicated to liberty, and the idea that the state should have the right to kind of control and contain large numbers of people without recourse simply on the say-so of, you know, a doctor or a parent, you know, you can see how that could be horrifying.
And involuntary commitment is historically a way in which men controlled women and racism
or in which
social justice factor there.
Or in which the we used to call retarded people were subject to involuntary commitment simply because it was more convenient than having them at home, you know. So the same kind of conditions, we consider those things, you know, monstrous and acts of tyranny, and we don't do them anymore. And yet it could be that in some of these isolated cases, the fact that we don't do it have these unintended consequences that we have to accept are part and parcel of the way that we function. Now that's where we start getting into public policy, which is, generally, these things happen, and then largely, particularly when it comes to gun violence, people on the, you know, liberals and Democrats and people on the left side of the ledger instantly go to the notion that the problem here is liberal gun laws, owing to, in their view, a misreading of the constitutional, the constitutional right to keep and bear arms, right? So, what is this? So we're going to go through this again, and what we'll go through is the whole question of, were these guns, it doesn't matter, the facts of these cases don't matter in general, because the idea is there are too many guns are bad, there are too many of them, they're too easy to get, and because they're too easy to get, people use them and they kill people and these mass events happen. And then it turns out that that's usually it turns out that that's not the story in these cases, that the guns weren't sort of procured in any way, shape, or form that the authorities could have prevented it necessarily, unless we lived in a country in which there were no guns. And as I always say in these cases, which is the thing that makes this so maddening to me, if today we had a national consensus that all gun sales should end and no gun manufacturer should ever work in the United States, everything like that, and you stopped all gun sales and they ended, there are still 300 million extant pieces of weaponry in the United States in private hands. 300 million handguns, rifles, you know, whatever. So what happens to them? They don't magically disappear, and people don't melt them down. In fact, you would also, you know, if you make this an illegal activity, then it is more likely, the more illegal you make it, that only criminals will be able to function in the trade for them.
The extent to which the usual suspects went about politicizing this event, without lack of a better term, this morning was faster than they normally go about it, which is usually remarkable alacrity. We went immediately from discussing this worst mass shooting in the history of the United States to talking about Congress's efforts moving forward to relax restrictions on the purchase of silencers and armor-piercing bullets, which, by the way, you can have a pretty robust discussion about whether or not that's smart policy. But it has nothing to do with what happened last night and reflects the extent to which just antipathy towards gun control dominates this discussion. When I had a conversation with people who were going out and saying, we need new gun laws. It doesn't matter what this guy used. We have no idea what he used. Who cares? Let's just talk about what happened in Newtown. I've got to remind people what happened after Newtown. There was a four-month press for new gun laws, for restrictions on magazine sizes, limits on magazines, and a new assault weapons ban. And it's all we talked about for 4 months. And in the end, it died a quick death in the Senate because four Democrats defected and wouldn't support the initiative, and resulting in the vice president and the president having a little contemptuous Rose Garden speech. I mean, it feels like nobody even remembers what we went through in 2012 and 2013 that was so formative.
They
definitely
don't.
For these individuals who are constantly talking about the need for new gun laws as though there aren't political impediments within the Democratic establishment.
Right. No, they definitely don't. They remember the sensation and the misery of the shootings, but they certainly don't remember the weeks long fallout afterward. And also, there's something that characterizes all these political moments when something like this happens, which is the politicizing takes the form of, when will they finally get it? When will conservatives finally get it? When will Republicans wake up? It's never a good faith discussion about, well, there are some reasons that some people oppose what you're describing as stricter gun laws. There are reasons that some people don't think that those are actually effective. They may even be counterproductive for all sorts of reasons. And that the supposed discussion that we're supposed to have never actually materializes in that way.
The other side of that argument doesn't exactly presume good faith in their interlocutors either.
Okay, so let's go through this as a matter of numbers. Okay, so. So there are 36% of American households, or something like that, I believe, according to the last thing I read, there are guns in 36% of American households. So if you want to know, this is how you got Trump, or this is, but I mean, beginning in 1994, this is how you got Republicans. This is how you got Republicans. If the culture war means anything, it is that certain types of urban liberal opinion find the idea of gun ownership horrifying, inexplicable, and incomprehensible and indefensible. And there are 100 million people in this country who live with guns in their homes every day and do not know what these other people are talking about. They don't use them. They're never guilty. They go out, they hunt. They want them in their house to. They live in the middle of nowhere. The cops can't get to them for an hour. You know, if an escaped convict comes up their driveway, they have no recourse. All of that. They need it for security. They feel like they need it for security. The Constitution gives them the right to own them, in their view. And this is a cultural divide. This is easily the largest cultural divide that we have. I mean, that's to say that I don't know anybody who owns a gun, you know, practically, or would want to own a gun and thinks everybody who owns a gun is insane. And this notion itself blinds so many people to the fact that, you know, enormous numbers of people live comfortably with guns in their lot with no conceivable threat to anybody. And you're saying to them that they are responsible for terrible things happening in the country. They are complicit in crime because they want to own guns. And I'm not talking about crime. NRA owners here, because or members of the NRA who are activists and who are. I'm talking about everybody.
Well, that sort of I'm that that little parable about, and it, you said not NRA owners, but NRA is plays a big role in this, in my view. That played out, I'm reminded of this, in August, in early August. God, it doesn't seem that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago. It was two months ago.
It does seem like so many things have happened in the interim. But there was an NRA campaign that sort of switched from advocating for hunting and gun rights in the age of Obama, when there was a genuine threat to maximalist gun ownership ideas, to now this culture warriorism, when that threat is completely dissipated. There is no threat to the NRA from Washington anymore, not right now. And so it became this attack on fake news and the New York Times and a variety of other culturally liberal institutions. And using really
and aggressive, right? We're going to come after you.
The clenched fist of truth was something Dana Loesch said, which was just a little excessive. And the response to that was from this prompted an internal Republican conservative debate over whether or not this was productive language, whether it was counterproductive, whether it was possibly dangerous, because it wasn't creating weakening the divisions between speech and violence, which is something that Republicans are frustrated at the left over all the time. And the response to this debate was from Democrats, from people like New York's 4th Congressional District Representative Kathleen Rice, who wrote that the NRA and Dana Loesch are quickly becoming domestic security threats under President Trump, which forced everybody, obviously, to abandon their internal debate and focus squarely on Kathleen Rice and how horrible she was. There is sort of an irrational fear on both sides of the gun debate, which I can't wrap my head around because I'm utterly ambivalent towards firearms ownerships. My dad has guns. I've shot his gun once. I didn't care then. I don't care now. It just does nothing for me. But both sides of this debate seem either really jazzed about guns or really terrified by guns, and I can't get a handle on either side of that position.
There is one thing, whereas it's two sides of the same coin. So on the one hand, you have people who say guns everywhere and all play, that guns are, you know, that these pieces of metal are evil in and of themselves because they can launch a projectile at somebody and it's not fair. And then, of course, you have the other side, which is everyone must have a gun in case the government comes after you. That's why militias, that's why the Constitution was written the way it was written, because the whole point is you can't rely on the state. And in fact, the state might need to take arms against the state if it's depredacious and wants to come after you. And both of these kinds of extremist views, I think
neither would recognize each other as such.
But they are. They're literally flip sides of the same coin. Either guns are evil or they are necessary to prevent the state from, you know, from tyrannizing you.
It's going to be Wolverines, and we'll retreat to the hills.
Right, except the Wolverines. Except the Wolverines of Red Dawn were facing a foreign invasion. Right. That's a whole separate idea.
But there's another dimension to this, and which is that there is a conservative pro-gun argument here that is grounded very concretely in data. And that is very hard for liberals to wrap their heads around, which the data speaks to the idea that when and where gun ownership is made more difficult, gun violence does not go down. In fact, there's many examples of it going up instead, and the reverse is also true. That in places where it is easier to obtain guns,
you're allowed to do concealed carry.
The argument for gun and the conservative gun argument is now that there needs to be reciprocity and all states need to have agreement across these laws, and that seems reasonable too, because the left also says, well, yes, gun laws across these states should agree. They're talking about obviously blue states should agree with red states, and red states believe that blue states should agree with them.
And then, by the way,
the Democratic liberal argument is essentially that we need to do something. Doesn't matter what it is. And it's not even essentially; it's explicitly. Right. We need to act. Action for its own sake. Damn your prayers.
In 1994, Bill Clinton and Al Gore believed after the November election that it was their moves on gun control that were the final impetus to that led to the Republican Revolution of 94. And if you think that the moves on that this cultural divide on guns is as plain a division along the Trump non-Trump border as we have. I mean, it's, you know, people watch different TV shows maybe, and they have different attitudes on various things and all that. But my guess is that if you ask a Trump voter whether he believes that people have the right to keep and bear arms under the Second Amendment, he will say, or she will say, yes. And if you ask a Hillary voter the opposite question, many of them, if not all of them, but most of them, and one of the ones that we would think were representative, would say no. And that is a pretty stark dividing line. And as it happens, despite the heat on this matter, when push comes to shove, people who vote on guns vote for guns. That this is something that's part of a set of attitudes that Democrats and liberals have. But it is not, we tested this. It is not their voting issue. There have been tests on this as a voting issue. For example, when Elizabeth Dole ran for president in 2008, she very much thought she could use gun control as an issue. She was going to be a conservative on gun control, and it ate her alive. Like it did not work in the Republican Party. And similarly, Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Party, only in 2016 did Hillary Clinton think that the culture had shifted so much that she could attack Bernie Sanders on guns. Remember? Was this whole thing about how Bernie Sanders loved guns, and he would love guns, and he was like, "Look, I'm from a rural state. Everybody in Vermont, one of the most liberal, has a gun, and that's a liberal state.
The most liberal gun laws,
right.
There's also,
and why? Because they all live in small towns, and they're in the middle of nowhere, and they don't have any cops.
But there's, I guess there's. I mean, that's illustrative of the fact that there really is no ideological. Unity on the issue of guns. You had even people
there
like Seth Moulton.
Right.
No, you had even people like Seth Moulton, who's a pretty conservative Democrat from Massachusetts. I had the pleasure of meeting him on Friday. He's a lovely gentleman. He's not a Nancy Pelosi fan, wants to unseat her, doesn't like the liberal direction the party in which is going. And he says today, I'm not going to observe a moment of silence on the floor of the House because that is tantamount to not doing anything. Just do something.
Yeah.
And the do something thing resonates even with non-liberal congressmen. I mean, as much as Bernie Sanders may be beholden to his constituents back home who have just an allergy towards gun laws in Vermont, which is weird.
Now, there's one.
It's not universal.
There's one more debate that tends to unspool out of these incidents. I haven't seen it happening yet, but it's the one about violence in media, which also divides people, right? So this is also grounded in data. I mean, there are a lot of studies. There's a whole body of psychological research about violence in media and its effects on behavior. That's another one. That the second that comes up, the very same people, the sort of coastal liberals, right, who are denouncing, who want to do something. They don't want to quite do something about that. They're not looking.
I wonder how that's going to go, though. That idea that you don't say that the media encourages violence because of free speech, and now that liberals are all coming out of the closet as opponents of free speech, I wonder whether they're going to hold on to that. I mean, look, the two pieces of data that made all of these arguments seem crazy were twofold. One of which was, if you said that violence on media caused people to be violent, or that gun ownership was causing America to be more violent, from 1993 to 2015, you had this gigantic drop in the amount of violence in the United States, including gun violence as a general rule, murders, crime drop of around 55% nationally, right, and higher in the high crime areas. Now, that's been reversed a little bit over the last 2 years, but this was always the telling thing, which is, okay, so you're going to tell me that liberal, the NRA has been winning victory after victory all over the place, and violence has been going down, so gun violence has been going down too. So you you have been disproven. Your contention is false based on the evidence. And then the same thing with media violence causing violence, which is that media violence has gotten worse and still nonetheless, you know, violence is going down. That's so right. So that's why the focus on spectacular events like mass shootings, because these are, you know, these are black swans in theory. They come out of nowhere. You can't defend against them, all of that. And yet by the same token, they are increasing in number. And we've just had one that seems like, you know, you're amazed it hasn't happened before. Somebody, you know, it happened once, right? When Charles Whitman went up to the tower at the University of Texas and started shooting down at people on the quad, right? Here we have somebody, he located a festival, he saw that there were windows above it, and he basically just started shooting down out the window at a crowd of 50,000 people.
Yeah, and by the way, this is the danger of talking about the Orlando shooting as if it were just another spree killing, because now when we have one, we're media tends not to talk about this factually. There's already discussion how there was Orlando and now there's this, as if they're the same thing, and they are.
Yeah. Orlando was a jihadist event.
That's right,
and this, from what we can tell so far, was not. Well, so, gentlemen, let us. Okay. Anyway. But let us move from the horrifying to the edifying, and from the dregs of Western civilization to its highest summits. Because, you know, so many of you listening to this podcast are curious, eager to learn as much as possible. We're that way, too. And we're particularly eager to promote and defend and advocate for the best and highest in Western civilization. And that's why we know you'll enjoy watching The Great Courses Plus as much as we do. With The Great Courses Plus, you can learn about anything that interests you from some of the world's greatest professors, unlimited access to stream and download thousands of different videos and so many topics, history, science, American history, you know, the history of ideas, even learn a new language or how to cook. Right now, we are paying particular attention to an aesthetic glory of Western civilization. The Great Courses Plus has been providing us a music series on the 30 greatest orchestral works, and we recommend checking it out. Dr. Robert Greenberg, music historian in residence with San Francisco Performances, is the man delivering these lectures on screen. And Abe, you've been watching some of Dr. Greenberg's lectures, and
it's you know, as I said, I raved last time, and I'll rave again. I mean, you know, it's very tragically there is no shortage of good reasons to go seek a deeper, richer understanding of the beautiful. And this does offer that. I was watching over the weekend. He had an in-depth lecture on Vivaldi and the Four Seasons. One of the interesting things about it was, so the Four Seasons is ostensibly based on these sonnets about the Four Seasons. But the sonnets are actually sort of such garbage that there's a lot of speculation that they were sort of cobbled together after the fact, and that, in fact, to sort of justify the musical works.
Fantastic. Yeah. See, I never knew that. That would be such a great thing to learn. So, and you can learn that from The Great Courses Plus, and we want you to experience that. So they're giving our listeners a full month of unlimited access to enjoy all of their lectures for free, but you need to sign up with the special URL I'm about to give you. Free month today. Sign up now at thegreatcoursesplus.com/commentary. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com. One word, /commentary. We thank The Great Courses Plus, The Great Courses, for sponsoring the Commentary Magazine podcast. So the other thing that happened over the weekend was, of course, a flurry of social media appearances by our president, starting Saturday morning, in which he unloaded on the mayor of San Juan for being nasty toward him, according to him, because she had been ordered to do so by Democrats, and saying that the people in Puerto Rico just wanted everything to be done for them, and then later calling her an ingrate or others ingrates, and then backing and filling and talking about how great everybody in Puerto Rico was once it became clear that maybe he had unloaded too fast, and that doing so in the middle of, you know, what may be the worst national disaster in American history, or in the history of an American protectorate, as what it sounds like so far, that, you know, maybe getting into it with a, you know, with a politician, you know, who compared to the colossus that is the president is like, you know, a tiny little figurine on the sidewalk. I would say this was a distressing set of events, and the in keeping with the distressing set of events, how the president managed to sort of call into existence a whole series of defenders on the right, who then sort of turned around to try to attack the mayor of San Juan, who, from what I read, is not a particularly good mayor and is very left wing, and, you know, is a defender of that terrorist who spent 35 years in jail and was just let out, and blah, 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 blah. But, like, what that has to do with this whole question, you know, and the whole question of the national response to this, you know, unique, horrible disaster in Puerto Rico was totally unclear.
Yeah, I mean, like, as we've said before, there is no fight that Trump considers himself to be above. You know, he'll get down there and have any fight. And on this question, his predecessors faced similarly, you know, sort of overwrought charges about mishandling things. I mean, Bush was completely destroyed on Katrina. Wasn't true, and he didn't lash out on the local government. There were grounds to, and he didn't. And Barack Obama was very bizarrely blamed for the BP spill during his, I guess it was his first term.
Yeah, 2010.
Yeah. And he didn't, you know, what did he do? He said, I'm trying to see who's ass to kick. That was his, he sort of came out, like, you know, right. sort of swinging, looking for the bad guy.
Bizarre cottage industry of liberal commentary that held that the president should be angrier and that he should display his anger towards BP and the tides and whatever, because they knew it was nonsense, that they just wanted to see some sort of engagement from him. And that was the frustration with Trump when people were talking about how this is Trump's Katrina and Trump isn't paying any attention to this. He just wasn't tweeting about it. There was plenty of evidence that you could cite if you had people on the ground, and people did have people on the ground and corrected this impression. But the notion that he was ignoring this early on was not supported whatsoever. It is slightly better supported now, because he spent the weekend tweeting about ingrates and dedicating a golf trophy at his New Jersey clubhouse to the displaced and storm-ravaged in Puerto Rico. You can't imagine worse optics.
Right. Well, here's what I would say. I think that the hunger to declare Puerto Rico his Katrina was very evident.
Transparently evident,
and was so evident, in fact, that it may have provided a necessary spur to make sure that FEMA and the military really did jump into Puerto Rico as fast as possible under these horrible conditions. And, you know, this is where he's such a great communicator, and he has such a razor-sharp understanding of his people and all of that. This is where his inarticulacy starts to become self-destructive. So that much derided thing that he tried to say when he said Puerto Rico is surrounded by water, lots of water, a big ocean, there's lots of water, you know, and then everybody sort of made fun of him because he sounded ridiculous. He sounded like, you know, Chauncey Gardner in Being There. And yet the simple fact of the matter is, if he could have said it more cleverly, what he would have said was, you know, our ability to get materiel to Puerto Rico, it's not in the United States, and most of our naval vessels are not parked right near there. A lot of them are out on, you know, in the South China Sea and you know, deployed all over the world.
He initially said that he wasn't going to rescind the Jones Act, which forces vessels to touch in U.S. port before they go anywhere else, including U.S. territories, that he wasn't going to do that because shipping interests wouldn't like it.
Right, but then he did. But then he said that the next day,
impulses are obviously that he didn't really consider this the world's most pressing issue. It wasn't like Houston to him.
No,
and
fair
people
enough.
Noticed.
Right. Now, I think the thing that is unjust to say is to say that, you know, we took care of Houston and Florida because there are a lot of white people there, first of all, there are a lot of black people in Houston, and there are a lot of Hispanic people in Florida. So that does that, you know, there are many things that you can accuse, you know, but to say that, you know, to say that a Salvation Project in Houston, which is one of the blackest cities in the United States, I think it's the most, right, but I think it is one of, in fact, of the large cities in the United States, it is, you know, it is among the ones that is most heavily African American. So that's a ridiculous point, I think, just as a matter of even simple logic and fairness. That said, he clearly does not feel like Puerto Rico is part of the United States. He keeps acting as though it isn't really, you know, it is, but it isn't. It's not a state, so it isn't there. And, you know, one of the interesting things about Puerto Rico that is quite striking is that its horrible financial condition, in which it was governed with great irresponsibility and piled up all this debt, that it is actually under federal orders that are different from from the 50 states. The states can actually do have the power to declare bankruptcy. Not that they do. It would be horrible if they did. They'd never be able to bond out a bond ever again. But Puerto Rico can't under the laws of the United States. So it is, in fact, more of a protectorate of the federal government than any individual state is. It's more under the thumb of the federal government than any individual state is. And therefore, arguably, when there is a natural disaster, the federal government, just as it would have to in a place like Washington, D.C., which does not have a state government, it would have to be the lead agency in doing things. And then to say something like they want everything done for them when, you know, when 5% of the island has power and no one has drinking water, what the hell is he talking about? I mean, you know, fine. So I'm sure people are staying there. They're trying to move trees out of the road so the trucks can get by. That's what
people
do. Well,
they do that. They should not forget their obligations to Goldman Sachs, by the way. He reminded them of they're in hock to Wall Street, and they should keep that in mind as they boil their water.
I mean, it's the whole thing. They can't even boil. What are they going to use to boil water with?
Burn the defoliated trees everywhere.
Right. So I mean, it's just a terrible, terrible approach, and it's heartbreaking. In fact, because if the relief effort has been positive, this just all turns it to like ashes and wormwood. You know, it just turns it bad. It makes you feel bad. Why? All he wants is to be praised for it, and he makes it impossible to get the praise that he wants for it.
I mean, he's going there tomorrow, and I'm not, you know, who knows what kind of reception he's going to receive, but I can't imagine it'll be as positive as it was in Houston, where he was greeted like a conquering hero.
Or as positive as it would have been had he gone last week, when both the notorious mayor that he now hates and the governor and all the public officials were actually saying words of thanks for the intervention of the federal government on Puerto Rico's behalf, which is, by the way, a sane and necessary way to put. And you can tell from things like Chris Christie's behavior after Hurricane Sandy, it is the natural human impulse when you are feeling desperate and terrified that this notion that, you know, the paternal federal government is going to come in and give you some help comes as a great relief. It may well be that, you know, the mayor got on the phone with lunatic leftist politicians in the United States, like Melissa Mark Viverito, the city council speaker in New York City, who is a terrible, awful, monstrous person, terrorist lover, and idiot, and who has been, you know, like saying horrible things about Trump. And maybe they had a conversation, and that was fine. You know, that's how it happened that she decided to go negative. It doesn't matter. And this is a national effort. It's not about Trump. It's a national effort. And it would be nice if we could all feel as though we are all, you know, collectively as a country trying to do something to help this suffering island.
Well, by the way, it also carries over to things like today when he got up there and spoke about the shooting in Las Vegas. And he talks about how in moments of crisis, we come together as a country. You can't help but look through that. Look at that, but through the lens of his insane divisiveness over the weekend.
That was scripted Trump. We're going to get extemporaneous Trump, because scripted Trump always is followed by untethered trauma.
Well, so tomorrow he'll be in Puerto Rico, and Wednesday he'll be in Las Vegas. Yeah.
He has a habit of resenting being lashed to responsibility.
Well, speaking of, we're also forgetting what I think has to be included among his top five craziest tweets, which was his tweet to Rex Tillerson.
Well, if we're going to mention that, we should at least in passing note that the Department of Health and Human Services is now headless and Tom Price has resigned. I mean, even amid a weekend's worth of news, we had not even touched on the fact that yet another member of the cabinet who will not be replaced or confirmed anytime soon has resigned.
Well, no. What do you mean, yet another member of the cabinet?
The first Department of Homeland Security is headless.
Yeah, but he didn't resign.
He resigned his position to become
White House Chief of Staff.
And nobody seems to have noticed or cared that the department responsible for curtailing illegal immigration to the United States and maintaining counterterrorism efforts, including domestic terrorism efforts, hint, hint, is led by an acting director who has no ability to navigate the West Wing like a political appointee would.
Okay, so just to get to the Tom Price thing, I mean, the fact that he lasted as long as he did after the first story about the planes is itself indicative of how the Trump administration itself must be saying, look, I can't deal with that. Like, let's not even talk about that. I've got so much other stuff to deal with, because he was down. The minute you read that story, you knew he was going down. And it was just like the fact that it took him 3 or 4 weeks of, you know, getting more that it went on like that was just bizarre and insane. The second thing about Rex Tillerson, this is a very interesting thing, because I would say nominally, we would probably agree more with the Trump worldview as expressed in the tweet, which was it's useless to negotiate directly with North Korea. But what he did was, Tillerson went and told the New York Times that he was negotiating with somebody, whatever, said he was negotiating directly with North Korea. And Trump then publicly said, I told our wonderful Secretary of State this was pointless. So
we'll do what we have to do.
Yeah. So if he's tweeting that it's pointless and Tillerson is doing it, then he could have just told Tillerson not to do it. He's Tillerson's boss.
Yeah, all the while, State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert was discussing these efforts in a very clinical fashion, as though there had been no policy change. But there's no input, I think, from the White House. We always thought that Tillerson was going to be one of the first to go.
I thought,
which point there would be a third agency that would have no political appointee as its head and nobody interested in replacing them and no time in the Senate calendar to schedule some sort of a confirmation hearing, even if there were somebody interested in replacing them.
Well, I do think this is one of the biggest issues here, maybe the biggest issue if you want to think about it, which is, so there's the Department of Health and Human Services open. And there was talk this weekend that, say, Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming, who is a doctor, might be the appropriate person to take it over. If you were John Barrasso, would you leave your Senate post to become the Secretary of Health and Human Services, seeing how Jeff Sessions was publicly humiliated after leaving his, and Tom Price, a representative of Georgia, is now out? I think you would be insane to go into the government if you had a position like that as an elected official, where you were suddenly going to have to start kowtowing to this weird, palace.
That's my concern, is that they will eventually find somebody who's interested in these positions, and they will not be men or women of the highest caliber.
Well, I mean, look, I'll give you an example. I'm not even going to say it. Forget it, because I don't want to get them in trouble. I mean, I can think of people who would be good for Health and Human Services who aren't elected officials, who are public servants who would be great and, put their heads down and do the job. And if I say anything, that probably is not good for their chances. So not going to say anything. But there are such people. There are such people in Homeland Security. There are such people. There are such people who could do state as well. But what they are not are people who are, leading figures of, in American society. Because I don't know why you would want to what reward you would get for subjecting yourself to this.
And this is not just Trump. I have a post up today, which you should all read, about how it's important to have political appointees at these places because they're subject to different pressures than professional bureaucrats and civil servants. It's worth reading.
Right, it is.
But it's also, there's this weird culture, and it has nothing to do with Trump, that goes back to forever, about how the department heads or agencies, cabinet-level positions, have to be like these statesmen and men of great stature with some sort of already existing footprint in the American culture. And it's like, why? Why does the Secretary of State need to be, you know, a professional diplomat that everybody, whose name everybody knows, when you have tens of thousands of professional diplomats you could pluck from obscurity who would do a ten times better job?
He obviously doesn't. I mean, it's the greatest secretaries of state of our time, like, you know, George Shultz. George Shultz had been Secretary of Labor and then ran a company and was a public policy intellectual of a kind. I mean, he was and he ran Bechtel and he had been a public official. One thing that you do seem to need to know how to do is have experience working in government, because the incentives and pressures and rewards of working in government are so different from the for-profit sector that you cannot, as I think Tillerson's horrible tenure and Paul O'Neill's tenure when he was Secretary of the Treasury, and John Snow's tenure when he was Secretary of the Treasury, and various other people's tenures when they were, because they only worked at for-profit company. They don't understand what the incentive structure is, and they don't know that they can't fire people, and they don't know how this works. And they never get their arms around it. So, at the very least, having some experience negotiating the functioning of the federal government is a necessary precondition to being.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves, because the reality is that John Kelly isn't replaced. He's not going to be replaced anytime soon. The Senate doesn't have time to replace him, even if somebody nominated him. HHS is going to be headless for a long time. Anybody who leaves is going to leave an agency with an acting director for who knows how long. The president has no interest in staffing up his administration. He did it reluctantly in the first place.
Right. Well, because, that's what happens when you have an accidental presidency, when you have somebody who doesn't think he's going to win. So, of course, the great joke was, as we now understand it, Chris Christie was making a transition plan, and then we got all these leaks about how Chris Christie was so terrible, and it turned out basically Jared Kushner threw Chris Christie over the side because he hated him, because Chris Christie had prosecuted his father for the crimes his father had committed, the evil, disastrous, monstrous crimes his father had committed. So he 86s Christie off the side, and then there's no transition plan, which means there's no way to staff the administration, which means nobody had done anything, because Jared Kushner is a putz. He's a loudmouth idiot putz, and let's face it, if he weren't the president's son-in-law, he would be, have his ass kicked into the East River. You wouldn't even believe it.
All the way from Washington.
All the way from Washington into the East River. And if you think that I'm understating the case with that moron jerk and his idiot moronity.
I said something like this on Morning Joe with a little less venom.
It's hot in this. It's gotten hot in our studio, and I'm very annoyed.
He is responsible for the thaw in relations between the United States and the Sunni states.
Jared's responsible for the thaw. Can he spell Sunni?
The thinking in the White House.
Yeah, can he spell? You know,
it was related third hand.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, he's responsible for the thaw. He heard of the Sunni Shiite distinction in probably mid December from somebody from Moscow. Anyway. And with that, we come to the close of a hysterical edition of the Commentary Magazine podcast, where I seem to have lost my cool. I was going to use another four-letter word there about what I lost.
Literally. And figuratively.
I don't know. It's warm. Oof. I condemned a lot of people. I condemned Melissa Mark Viverito. I condemned Tom Price. I condemned Jared Kushner. I'm an avenging angel today. So
they had it coming,
because it's so hot in the studio. My God, it's so hot in here. Anyway, and we've gone on for a long time. So for Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman, I am John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.